Good morning. Welcome to the Order of Time, to the occasion of the New Year and Christmas. To this purpose, I would like to talk a little longer than the usual talk of 20 minutes to discuss everything connected to this new year we are having now. There are four types of new year, or three types, factually. These are the scientific new year, the astronomical new year, reckoning from the shortest day, which is yesterday, a day before yesterday. There is the Christian new year, which is in fact Christmas. We celebrate the birthday of Jesus Christ. And originally, and there's this the civil new year, which is celebrated the 1st of January, and which can also be celebrated in March. Some cultures do that in March, because March would be the first month of the year. Christmas is a festivity of peace and also of commerce. This is a religious occasion. Even Santa Claus is a holy man. Santa means holy, and he's also known in Europe, not especially as Santa Claus, but as the original holy bishop from Turkey, who saved children and who gladdened them with presents. And this holy bishop, good for the children, was exported to America, partly by the Dutch community living in America, and he somehow ended up in Canada, and there he got another hat instead of the bishop's hat, and so he's a kind of Santa Claus, you know, the holy man of celebrated in Holland especially, who's on winter sport. He's having a sledge instead of a boat, and he's having this funny winter cap on his head instead of the holy symbol of Rome for a bishop, and so he is he's the same person, in fact, the same. It's a Christian Catholic symbol, Christmas, and Santa Claus. So this is one and the same person, and this is important to know for the rest of the world, because for many people, Christmas is not connected with Christ anymore. It's not the birthday of Christ for many people, because many people don't believe in Christ at all. They believe in having presents, though, and in the Santa Claus. But effectually, historically seen, you cannot separate Santa Claus from the respect for Christ, including the Holy Bishop from Turkey. So this is all one and the same new year, celebrating the birth of Christ, and this is a religious new year, upcoming days, and the present day is the astronomical new year, which is the philognostic new year. In love of knowledge, we base ourselves in our fundamental order on scientific terms, because we were religious, but we got reformed in respect of nature. We got enlightened, and we found reason and motive with Christ, not especially in denial of Christ. No, to the contrary, we are acknowledging Christ And let me explain you about the connection of this scientific new year with the Christian one. Christ is in fact a very scientific person who reminds us to do it on earth as in heaven. And this is associated with the reason why Christ was born in Israel, in Judea, in Bethlehem. And his purpose on earth. The purpose of the Lord, the person, the great incarnation of God descending to earth, is a purposeful happening. It doesn't happen just like that because it's nice weather or something, or because he's always welcome. No, the great personality of God, not just Jesus, but all prophets and great personalities incarnate because they are necessary. They take place in time and circumstances where the culture of God is in decline, where righteousness is at stake, where the goodness and the love between people is forced into strangeness, into something odd. So what was going on when Christ was born? This is important to know. At the time Christ was born, just shortly before that, a new calendar was introduced by a man called Caesar, who was the emperor of Rome, and who got into trouble with that rule of his. He introduced the lunar calendar as a solar one. Before that, it was a purely lunar one, neatly leaped regularly, or neatly, not that neatly. It, in fact, was corrupted, the culture of leaping. And people tired of that corruption inspired Caesar to introduce the solar calendar. The lunar calendar was simply stretched with 10 days, and thus they had a better calendar. Now they thought, we have a better culture because now we don't have to leap it, and we don't have that corruption anymore of arbitrarily ruling with that leaping of the lunar calendar. So the solar calendar would be a solution to that problem. But that was an illusion. A great confusion rose. Not because the order was restored, and thus people had to realign to their culture. No, in fact, it went deeper. Simply to abolish the moon is simply not possible. It sounds simple, but it cannot be done. The order of the moon is irrevocably present in the sky and cannot be abolished. So you cannot abolish the full moon and replace it by a solar one without presenting the people with a conflictuous perception. The same habits were suddenly not in line with the lunar order anymore. And this constitutes a defiance of natural conditioning. People are, and not just people, also animals and plants, are by nature conditioned to live their lives as devotees of the natural order. It is a fundamental notion of religion. I think of Islam, for instance, who have their prayer times to the pure sun and moon. It is a fundamental issue to align with nature. So, at a fundamental level, disturbing the converting the cultural order into another order, which simply shifts the attention from the moon to the sun, is of course a tour de force, a forceful thing, which breaks the people relating to their natural foundation. And of course, this is the cause of great chaos. After Julius Caesar was murdered shortly after this operation of time reform, the Roman Empire split in two. There were two camps of successors to the throne of Caesar. There was Mark Antony and there was Octavian, and there was a great struggle in the empire. And they both would rule in peace together, each a part of the empire, but that didn't turn out to be so. Mark Antony fell in love with the same woman as Caesar had been in love with, and these two were types of love for the same lady, which was Queen Cleopatra of Egypt. Turned out to be a thorn in the side of, or in the eye even of the Roman rule. They couldn't tolerate this offense of Mark Antony, that he would neglect the integrity of Rome and turn it into a kind of Eastern field culture of Egyptian associations. So. Octavian plotted against Mark Antony and betrayed him. It was a betrayal, and the Roman Empire fought itself. It had fallen into a kind of civil war, and well, this war was won by Mark Antony's opponent Octavian, who was crowned August. Emperor August, the same emperor who crucified Jesus. And so you cannot think Jesus apart from this historical condition. Jesus, well aware of the matters of God and nature and how people should behave with each other in love and in respect of truth, had come to restore the order of God on earth. So Christianity can be understood as the defiance of this repression of the lunar order by the Caesarian rule, by the rule of Caesar, which had split up the Roman Empire and had resulted in the rule of the murderer and betrayer, Octavian, or August, who also killed Jesus. By his rule, Jesus was called a lunatic. So Jesus came to restore the order. He explicitly said that we should do it on earth as in heaven. And he also asked the question, what is truth? Is truth the matter of the sun? No, truth is not just the matter of the sun. Truth is also a matter of the moon. In fact, truth is a matter of consciousness. The consciousness of time always consists of two matters, the matter of the sun and the matter of the moon. And to have a culture in accordance with as well the moon as the sun is a problem. And the old Roman Empire, which was purely lunar, had a great problem with it. The reform of Caesar had a great problem with it just as well, because it couldn't cope with both the orders at the same time. So Jesus came to restore this order. And Christianity thus must be understood as the sincere mission to restore this natural consciousness, and that's exactly what we defend at the Order of Time, this site with the approach we call phylogenosy, we defend the combination, the ideal combination of a sun and a moon, the solar and the lunar order. These two orders combined in one calendar. In fact, we restore the abolished Julian calendar introduced by Julius Caesar, and call it the chakra order, because there's a connection between the Gnostic interest of Christianity and the Eastern interest in spirituality, as we have learned it from gurus in the last century, arriving here and presenting us with scriptures we have never read before. These are the Puranas, the storybooks of the Hindus, and they tell us pretty accurately that this practice of respecting the moon and the sun is correct in their conception of philosophy. So it is not just a Gnostic notion of aligning with the natural order. It is also supported by a classical book called the Bhagavata Purana. Christianity is connected to the Eastern culture in unexpected ways. Christ, to the occasion of Christmas, we may say, died at the cross for us as the master of sacrifice, and we remember him that way, especially as he resurrected from his death on the cross. This is a very important thing to remember, because he led the way in us sacrificing our own egos. The cross stands for the ego that must be carried as a burden until the job is done. And after that job is done, that ego disappears. That cross is lifted from your shoulders, and you are reborn as a devotee to the original Father. That is how Christ modeled this business of the ego, of finding its end. So the ego is finite, is what we learn from Christ. We see that if we do a job, if we show our face and develop our desire to be a master of something, that this is an endeavor with a beginning and an end. This is a burden to have success in the world. You might be hankering after it and desiring after it and realizing it, but once you are there, the next step is to realize that this is a burden, which is a hindrance in your own personal development. It is a threat to your intelligence. It steals your mind, because you cannot just take the position of the great master of the world. You are not the great master of the world. So you have to fit into a certain type of order, in which you are more a devotee in a more modest position. So this ego of ours must be subdued by a greater interest, and that is usually called the interest of the soul. So Jesus led us the way, and he resurrected. He didn't really die in the sense of a physical death. It seemed to be so that he died physically, but in fact, it was the ego that died. When he resurrected, his own pupils couldn't recognize him anymore, because he would be dead. He would be dead. His ego wasn't there anymore. So who is this man with these wounds at his hands and at his feet? And in the side, which proved that it was the same person. but they couldn't believe it because we are conditioned to our egos. We look outside and see egos. I am an ego. You are an ego. He has such hair and such talk and such gait and whatever. And but once we are broken in this burden, once we have this burden is lifted by fate, by God from our shoulders, and we are another person. Suddenly, we are half the man we used to be. We have songs singing this, and this is of great relevance to the world. It is a message of peace to realize from Christ that at one hand we have to carry our burden, and at the other hand, that there is liberation, that there is resurrection. It is not sad news that Christ died. It is good news that Christ died because he resurrected. So this resurrection of Christ is of prime importance to understanding our own evolution in life. We have to know that there's an end to the sufferings of our egos, even if we... or especially when we become popular, we are the popular aim also of not just of appreciation, but also of hatred and also of envy, and also of all kinds of other projections by the common people who desire a kind of lordship which we never can fulfill as a mission. So we are also always just this one person with his limitations and her things and whatever. So we are liberated in the love of Christ to serve our Father less of ego and more of soul. So this ego is limited and the soul is promoted, and that is the peace message of Christmas too. The essential basic importance and relevance of Jesus' appearance in the world is also his disappearance, the disappearance of his outer form as a preacher and as a ruler of people, as a master over his pupils and all this. So he transformed into a spiritual being, a kind of devotee of his own cause, and there's more to this story than just this theologically known reality of carrying one's karma, one's cross, and abandoning the ego for the sake of the soul. There's more to this, and there's also a mystery connected to this. Jesus, as a young boy, 12, 13, left home, left Judea, and went traveling, very young as he was. And there are reports from India. There's physical evidence of a man having traveled India, being called Issa, who answers to the description of Jesus as a very highly spirited great personality. In defense of the interest of all people, who was who learned to be very close to the masters of a certain school in Hinduism. Jesus is known as a sampradaya, as a school, as a disciplic succession in India. There is a sampradaya called the Isha Sampradaya, which is a truth more or less secret, that hardly any Christian knows. This is the secret life of Christ. The classical scriptures of Christianity do not really know what Jesus did between his 12th and his 30th year. This has been researched, and reports have been found of him appearing in India as a great personality among the Eastern gurus there, between the classical authorities of the classical schools of India. So the conclusion of this study is that Jesus represents a certain branch of Hinduism. So, as such, Christianity is a branch of Hinduism, and this is not very well known. Christianity has been quite a negative with its own mission in the world. There was Saint Thomas who was sent to India to preach Christianity there, and in defense of Christ in India, he founded this Thomas Christianity, closely associated with this Sampradaya. But the Portuguese, the Christians from Portugal, who had a colony in Goa in India, they repressed and persecuted the Christians there, the followers of Thomas, because they would be they would be stray cats. They would be heretics to the Christian purpose, to the Christian purity of the Christian Church of Rome. They considered it a lost cause of Christianity because it was too Hindu-like. The Thomas Christians were more like Brahmins who behaved like Hindus, and this was all wrong. So the Portuguese organized a persecution, and they destroyed all the books of that culture, so that it would be wiped off the earth. So this sampradaya of this Isha sampradaya, the school of Jesus in India, was repressed by Christianity itself operating in India. But still, it remains. There still remains of the Isha sampradaya in India. They are just as rare as the Jews in the rest of the world. But they do exist. There is a serious form of Hinduism which is directly rooted in the person of Christ. Christ, who reportedly, after his crucifixion and having returned to the pure devotion with the Father as a purely spiritual and not material person, returned to his former masters in India, and there he lived the rest of his life, and the people following him there are just known as the Isha Sampradaya, the Ishanis, and the Ishani Sampradaya. This it's a real branch of Hinduism. So there's a connection between the philosophy of India, the religion of India, and the religion of the Middle East. So, and for a peace message to Christmas, it is important to realize that to find a solution to the conflicts of the Middle East, that there is a connection, a historical connection, to India. Let me explain this to you. The fugue between the brothers in the Middle East, between Christians, between Jews and Muslims, is a broader conflict. They are nephews to the founding father of Abraham. Many theorists have proposed that one of the solutions possible for the Middle East is to realize that the unity of the religion of the Middle East, which is the religion derived from the sons of Father Abraham, the founding father of the integrity of the spiritual and religious interest in the Middle East. This founding father would unify the Middle East. But this, as a religion, it doesn't really exist. There are no temples for Abraham, nor as specific forms of worship or an extensive literature. So this is a theoretical idea, and but still it's of importance. It is true that the people of the Middle East are united in Abraham, but it's also true that this Abraham represented the Old Testament truth of the Jewish culture, which in Genesis is described in the chapter on the old time, as influenced by the sons of God. Jesus called himself the Son of God, and he is respected as the only Son of God. But factually, to the Bible, the Son of God is a plural. It's not a singular notion, it's a plural notion. There are sons of God mentioned in Genesis. So, Son of God, why did Jesus call himself the Son of God? It was because he as the representative of this Indian sampradaya of these this Hindu integrity, as a representative of that, he was fully adapted, as intelligence does, fully adapted to the culture, and he spoke to the heart of the Jews as a son of God. He referred to this chapter in Genesis where the sons of God were reported to have come over the mountains to mix with the Jewish people, which resulted in the fact that they didn't live for more than 100 years since. So reports the Holy Scripture. So if we take the Bible seriously, we must acknowledge that this Son of God idea is a notion of Christ adapting to the Jewish culture, but still referring to the truth that the Jews originally, and so also Islam and Christianity following Christ, that they are part of this culture, that they are influenced by these sons of God who came over the mountains. Well, the mountains in the Middle East are not in the West. They are in the east of the Middle East, the Himalayas, and sons of God coming down the mountains are also described as Aryans, the civilized people of the Brahmin culture. And these sons of God, they brought this message of love and integrity to the spiritual order, to the West, partly because it is the way to find God, to preach God. The Vedic culture had fallen about 3,000 years before Christ. This culture was the root culture of our humanity, the denial of which is disastrous to us. This root culture of the oldest language we know in the world is fundamental to our humanity. There is in history no better example of perfect philosophy with God as we find in India. We are proud of our own theology. We are proud of our own religious associations, of our own temples, and of our own self-realization in emancipation. This is the purpose, that each takes responsibility from within his own culture, from his own realization. This is the enlightenment mission in the West of the preachers. And preachers like Jesus and Muhammad and others, who remind us of what is essential in philosophy. The notion we have of God in the Middle East is that of the impersonal, not necessarily impersonal, but the immaterial God in the beyond, who is indeed personal as well as impersonal. It is a Holy Spirit equal to everyone, but also a Father. So there's a Father and a Son, also from Hinduism. The Father is called in India Vishnu. Vishnu is the Father. Krishna, one of the avatars of Vishnu in India, specifically called himself the Father. Vishnu, the original Vishnu, is the Father in heaven, who is the unseen one. You do not see him; he's always in the beyond. Vishnu is a purely transcendental form. He's portrayed with four arms and carries also a few items. One of those items is the so-called chakra. This chakra stands for the cyclic of time. The cyclic of time is the order of the universe, is the creative order, which Vishnu carries as his weapon, because anyone in defiance of this cyclic order is a loser. You cannot maintain your life if you don't keep this structure, this order of the cyclic, your agenda, your calendar. You must meet the demand of the chakra order. This notion of Vedic truth professed in the Middle East by the sons of God, which as a plural, leads us back to our initial idea of the order of time in relation to Christ and the appearance of Christ for the sake of peace on earth. This cyclic order, this chakra order of associating with nature, the positive way, the conscious way, the mature way, not the repressive way, not to repress the moon with the sun or the sun with the moon, or be corrupt in our leaping practices. This interest is not an original Middle East notion, as some might think. It is not an invention of Jesus himself. Jesus just referred to classical wisdom. It is not a novel idea to do it on earth as above. So above, so below is a classical precept from many spiritual disciplines. The astrologers also work with it. And if you scour the philosophical literatures of Greece, you see also that Plato says that we should live to the heavenly pattern. And so this is not a strange idea. Jesus just summarized it for us, that the truth of our consciousness is found in nature, in the association especially with the sun and the moon. In India, they are two gods. They are Chandra and Surya, together adding up to the consciousness of Vasudeva. This is a kind of clock of God we talk about. This is the fundamental clock that nobody can manipulate. This is the sun and the moon moving in the sky against the backdrop of the stars. And this is the clock we should read from. This is the order of God. This is created by or supported by natural laws. This is the peace formula. Just see it as it is of the natural law. You don't have to speak of God even. It is not necessary to speak of God, because many scientists say, oh, that's nonsense, that's just impression-making, some hysterical person drawing attention to himself because he wants to manipulate people or something. No, that's not it. I'm a scientist myself. I'm a psychologist doing some yoga and thus realizing the connection between Christ and the Far East philosophies of Hinduism. Right? So there's nothing I want to achieve but to do my job. What else should one do? I do my job and tell you how your conditionings are and to what authorities you refer when you depend on a certain order of time. And understanding Christ and Christmas and the necessity of peace in the Middle East, I have to say that as a psychologist, I can say, it's important to know the authority of what you tick to, what you submit to. Do we submit to Jesus and to Muhammad and to Krishna, who all say, and to Plato too, who all say, do it on earth as in heaven? Or do we submit to authorities that say, okay, you don't want, I can help you. I can inspire you with a one-sided political mind and tell you that you can conquer the world that way, which is not true. You cannot conquer the world with a one-sided option, because the other side will also always be your enemy and, as a natural opposite, always be there. So that is perfectly clear to which order we would belong if we seek peace. So Jesus is a Hindu, although he adapted perfectly to the local situation of the Jews. He was, he's a part of Hinduism. And we should realize in the Middle East, if we want to find peace, that the whole culture is in fact inspired by this root of our culture. And so another objection you could make in this connection is that to say that, okay, maybe Jesus was inspired by the sons of God, and maybe the Jews were influenced by the preaching of Hindus who came to the West and were known as sons of God and were very influential. You can say so, but the Hindu culture proved itself a mistake. It fell down. And yes, indeed, the culture fell down. But the same way as we, as Christians, pray for the resurrection of Christ in our hearts, the Hindus pray for the resurrection of their whole culture, of the Vedic culture, of the culture of knowledge, in their own hearts, in their own lives. But they are not illusioned about it. They know very clearly that this is modern times, the political times, in which respect is not automatically guaranteed for whatever in whatever position, for whomever in whatever position. So they are not illusioned about this. They don't. Many Hindus will say, okay, we are a foreign culture. We are not the Vedic culture. We know we are materialist. We know we are in Kali Yuga and addicted to politics and split up because of our limitations. It is for us so. But why do you blame this? Well, it's for you just as well the same. You are also split up in political parties. We are materialists, occupied by our own weaknesses and propensities for offenses against the traditional rules, sins as they call it, which is just a type of profiteering. But we are not different. We are all in the same boat. It is not fair to say Hinduism is wrong and it's primitive because it's just a lot of idolatry of chaotic people who can't take care of themselves. This is not just. This is not right. We are all chaotic. This is modern times, and we have lost the original order of time. That is the message of Jesus. Jesus says, "Do it on earth as in heaven." It is the message of Muhammad. He says, "Do the pure of the sun and the moon." It is the message of Plato, who says, "Live to the heavenly pattern." It is the message even of science. Be valid in your measurements. Know what you measure. Linear time is simply bad leaping or no leaping at all. And from no leaping, we have weeping. We realize we are destructive, caught in a linear mind in defiance of nature. But nature always defeats us that way. Our linear options are just compensations of a pragmatical mind. In pragmatics, we say, oh, it's too tedious to leap the week every fortnight with one day and just have 48 hours and just this way sacrifice a 13th month of vacation, which we need to relax. Distributed over an entire year, this is a sacrifice you have to make for world peace, because world peace is the only option we have to survive. If we continue fighting with Christians and Muslims about a bad calendar and a bad clock that misalign with nature in the order of the week and in the order of the day, not fitting in with the sundial, as I explained before, then we have no chance for survival. In fact, we are just destroying ourselves in defiance of something which is inevitable, which is absolute in its natural laws. What foolish creature would go against his own environment? This is We think ourselves intelligent, but many animals are far more intelligent in aligning to the natural order. In fact, we threaten all beings on Earth with the present-day politics of bad ecological policies, polluting the air, killing the sea, life in the seas, having a bad order of time. Our survival on the planet is at stake. Will we survive this? And this is important to remember if you want to find peace at Christmas. If we want to respect Christ and say our prayers or appreciate Santa Claus, which is also a department of holiness. If we want to do this, then we have to realize that there's more to this than just having presents or saying prayers in church. It is associated with the integrity of the world citizen, realizing that he is any culture, whether it's Chinese culture, Confucianism, whether it's Hindu culture, whether it's Middle East culture, Islam, whether it's Christianity or South American interest. They have also traditions of relating to the universe. They have their own. They have even calendars to Venus. So we cannot escape this command of nature when we want to find peace with Christmas. This is the realization we are presented with. If we are in love with knowing, which would be the fundamental characteristic of us human beings, defined as Homo sapiens, we are the ones who know. So how can we live without loving the knowledge? How can we live without phylogenesy? We are phylogenesy. We must love this, because ignorance is destroying us and the planet. We have to be inspired by Jesus, but not only by Jesus. This the time of just a religious arrogance that Jesus would be the only one speaking the truth must be over. This is not realistic anymore. Muhammad spoke the truth when he told his people to find their confidence in the laws of nature. This is what Allah is, a lawful reality. Jesus says the same. There's no difference, in fact, between the two missions. And the Hindus say the same. They say, worship the sun god, worship the moon god, the god of the moon, worship the god of the celestial sky. It's all the same order of time. It is whether Muhammad says it, Jesus says it, or Vyasadeva says it in the Purana, it is all the same. Christianity should realize that the integrity of what it stands for, Jesus, is classically respected in the Gnostic department. Gnosis is the integrity of Christianity. In phylogenesy, we are partly Gnostic, partly, not completely, and not in all respects we are Gnostic, because we are just as well Vaishnava, we are just as well Sufi, we are just as well Buddhist, we are just as well Hindu, and we are just as well Taoistic. All these different aspects play a part in the love of knowledge, phylognosy, that we profess at this site, and which I defend for the coming year, realizing who we are relating to time. So we as Gnostics, the integrity of Christianity is the Gnostic integrity. The different churches are schools that try to prove themselves better than the other, but that's not the integrity of Christ. Christ doesn't prove himself better than himself. That's lunacy. That is foolishness. Don't get me wrong. Don't think that different churches, different schools of Christ, would be foolish. Now, to think that Christ would be a different man from this. In fact, the schools of Christianity lead you to inspire to know Christ. And to know Christ is to know the living Word. Christ is the living Word standing for the heart of mankind, not specifically the ego, but to the soul of that wisdom. And the soul of that wisdom is the Gnostic integrity. Christ is a Gnostic integrity. There's a few books important to this science of phylogenology. This is not just the Bhagavata Purana that is important. This is also the Nag Hammadi scriptures that are important. In these scriptures, we find references to the integrity of Christ that remind us of the integrity of Hinduism too. There's no direct reference in the Gnostic scriptures because it wasn't really known, especially not in the early days. Only lately we have this communications age where we all know of everything of each other. But those days it wasn't that way. But still, we find this inspiration of Christ back in the Gnostic integrity of Christianity. For instance, the concept of the pleroma is a concept which means the fullness, the opulence, the complete wealth of God, the pleroma. And this concept is a standard Vedic concept. In Vedic culture, it's called bhaga, and it's the sixfold opulence of the Lord, meaning intelligence, knowledge, power, beauty and harmony, renunciation, fame, and riches. These are the opulences of the Lord. We often think of these opulences if we are Christians. We want to be famous. We want to be rich. We want to be knowledgeable, intelligent. We want to be in harmony and beauty. We want to be of beauty. But this desire is, in fact, the corruption of our culture. We don't go for power for the sake of power. Power is a means. We don't go for money for the sake of the money. Money is a means. We don't go for beauty for the sake of beauty. No, beauty and harmony is a means to arrive at a proper idea of reality, a proper analysis. So this, to confuse the means with the end, is what we call corruption. And this is what we fight in phylogenology. The materialist may be confused of connecting these opulences, this bhaga, this pleroma, to the vision, which is the purpose of it all, that we arrive at an integrity of vision. The soul is a vision. The soul is also described as the seer. So the soul is the seer of the vision, which is an integrity of God, one spirit, one Jesus, one Krishna, one prophet in our heart, telling us what is conscious, what is enduring, what is happiness. And the soul is happy, knowledge of knowledge above the material reality. And this we find free choice, freedom of choice, self-realization, and command. We are in command of ourselves then, and not especially in command of others, but of ourselves. We can determine our own fate once we are in the transcendental position. So this is all Gnostic realization, which is in effect determining the integrity of Christianity. So with Christ, we are reborn when we have abolished our worldly attachment of ego. And then we are have a second birth as a devotee of God, as a born again Christian, or as a born again whatever. There's more types of being reborn than any rebirth organization would acknowledge. You can be reborn as a Hindu, having been a Christian, or you can be reborn as a Muslim, having become a Christian, or you can become a Muslim having been a Christian. So rebirth is a natural reality of people starting a new life. But there's also a third birth to respect. And that is, once you instituted your devotion, once you learned your trade of serving the Lord, there's a third birth, and that is to be the priest of your own culture, to be the responsible one of sacrifice. You arrive inevitably at your own routine, because your ego of making it is over, and you have to serve that what has been settled by yourself in your own rebirth, in your own commitment to the holy cause. And this third birth is of relevance to the present situation in the world. We are arriving at a world order, and we developed a lot of ego, and postmodern people know that this ego has ended in a terrible sense of relativity, to which we can only conclude that all this relative ego can only find peace to the backdrop of natural lawfulness, which is the original nature of God, which founds the original stability of our consciousness, in which we are all the same soul with different egos. There's ego, of course. There's no denial of ego, but there's also this subjection of ego. The ego is subjected to fit into a general culture. Each world culture is an ego. The Jews are an ego. The Christians are a collective ego, a super ego, as Freud called it, super ego, a moral agent who tells you what to do and what not to do, with different means. These differences are differences of collective ego. It's still ego, and also this ego has to die and to arrive at an order, a world order, which is there already. I do not make anything. I as a psychologist, I just tell you what the natural order of conditioning is. We are conditioned to dates, solar dates, which is an absolute of nature, displayed by the seasons and confirmed by our own science. And there's the absolute of lunar phases. And I'm not professing anything but lunar phases running through solar dates, divided by the same order of that same moon, dividing to its own calendar. So I'm not telling you anything new. This order is just what I realized and what I hope the whole world will realize as the final order at which we have to arrive to find peace, and our egos, also the religious and political egos, subjected. We are all subjected to this natural law, this natural time, this lawful reality of time, matter, and space, or ether. The force field of space we call ether. There's no way out of this. This is an absolute, and this is a third birth to arrive at a final order, which gives room and is the foundation of happiness for every world citizen. From when we have peace with this, there will be prosperity. This is what I wanted to tell you for Christmas and the new year. I thank you for your attention.